Welcome to What Moves You, a Speedway Motors podcast for people who love cars. I'm Joe McCullough, and today we're talking with Robbie Unser. He's part of the legendary Unser family and really has been there and done that. He's going to talk about life in a famous family, how he got his start, and what it's really like to run at Indy. Later on, our own Bill Schneider joins Robbie to talk about the engineering involved in building race cars that can handle Robbie's abuse. The first thing that I want to ask you is just where it started. What was the first race you were ever in? The first competition, was it a foot race in grade school, or were you in a go-kart, or what was the first race you ever drove in?
Probably go-kart. So for me, when I was younger, you know, it was a different time. Of course, I'm kind of old. So, you know, we only had go-karts. There weren't many mini bikes available. There weren't, you know, these cool things kids now can run around their house with, an electric car and stuff like that. So for my siblings, Al Jr., I'm the youngest. So you got Al Jr., 6 years older, my brother Bobby Jr., 12 years older. So we had go-karts. These are the days, you know, Mark A. carts, McCulloch chainsaw engines. So Al Jr. and Bobby Jr. are racing. I'm 4 years old. My dad decides it's time for me to do it, puts me in a go-kart. Al Jr.'s go-kart, actually, his Margay, fix the pedals and whatnot. I'm pretty small. We go to the racetrack. My dad stands in the middle of the corner. That's how he teaches me not to turn in early. He has a stick. He hits me with a stick if I lift too soon. So that was my first trip in a go-kart. So I started racing. That didn't work well. Of course, I drove through the fence instead of getting hit the second time. So I ended up actually at seven starting go-kart racing. So I was kind of a regular kid up until seven. My mom's parents had a big ranch out in Moriarty. So, you know, I did a lot of ranching and just fun stuff. So seven, you know, in my family, it wasn't, do you want to race? That really wasn't the option. It was, you're going to race, so you start when you can. So 7 years old, I start racing. I race karts till about 14. Then my dad ends up getting me my driver's license a year early. He goes to the DMV, said he's ready to drive. They give me a license. They give me tests. They say, how old are you? Or what's your birthday? They go, whoa, that's illegal, man. What? Okay, let's change your birthday. So my dad changed my birthday. So it literally 2 years ago, I finally, at 50 years old, got my proper birthday on my ID. I'm not even joking.
If anybody in the state of New Mexico is listening, just mute for a moment.
Well, you know, all those, that's just the way it was back in those days. So 14 and a half, I got a driver's license. I got a truck. I got a 68 Camaro that I was going to be racing that year, and I was told, now you have to pay for your insurance on a truck, and you're going to be making money. Oh, by the way, you can't play any high school sports because you're now a pro sports person because you've accepted money by a sport. So baseball, football, basketball, that's out. You know, my dad presented opportunities for me, but really it was the people around, other people that were around because of him that I think taught me a lot, you know. So you got to also understand my dad was still racing. So, you know, he was still quite intense in his own right, as was Uncle Al. So, but for all of us, it was, you know, we rode big bikes. I remember Al Jr.'s first motorcycle was full size. He had to get a milk crate to get on it, start it up, he'd ride it till it ran out of gas, it'd fall over, he'd walk home, and somebody'd have to go pick up his bike. This is what we did. When I was six, I got a little Aramachi Harley, which was a cool kind of a mini bike, so I was the first one that actually had a mini bike. So that's what we did. We raced. We go forward to me being 16. I win the two championships that I raced when I was 14 and 15. They're locally in Albuquerque. The second year, I raced a full wedge late model, kind of like the Randy Sweet car we have over there in the museum deal. Did that at, you know, 15 going into 16. Won the championship in Albuquerque, was third in the one up in Black Hills. So my high school was, I didn't go to school Friday. I got up Friday. I got on a plane. I went to, flew to South Dakota, Rapid City, South Dakota. I drove a race car that night. I got up. I flew home Saturday and raced that night. And, you know, that was my sophomore year of high school. By my senior year, I quit, get my GED halfway through the year and go World of Outlaw racing with Casey Luna. So we're what, first semester in high school, I guess. And I'm gone for 4 months.
Yeah.
You know, no cell phones, calling mom, you know, once a week, tell her I'm still alive on the pay phone, and went racing. So kind of started early. There wasn't any formal education. All my education was pretty much on the street, racing and doing what I did, but it was great. Sammy Swindell, pretty much, I would say, is, I probably wouldn't be alive today without him. Him and Amy took me under their wing. They bought me tires. They bought my safety equipment. I pitted next to him every race. So I definitely, in my sprint car stuff, I mean, what I owe Sammy Swindell is just actually unmeasurable, what him and Amy did for me, you know, my life. So those were neat years. I learned a lot. Right after sprint cars, I got in and did the skip. I went to, Casey Luna got me to Skip Barber Racing School. So I went out and did that, did very well in that school. Skip offered me a ride, a sponsored ride. I just had to get a sponsor to get to the track, okay, for my expenses. Sure. And a doctor, a heart doctor that was in my class, heard Skip offer me this and stepped up and said, I'll do that. And so him and his wife actually for me. I'm, you know, I'm 16, 17 years old.
Yeah.
They pay for me to my expenses. Skip gives me a car, and I drive in the first ever season of, you know, the Skip Barber Pro Series. A lot of really good guys, like I said, Brian Till, and I mean, there was some really, it was a heady group, very competitive, a lot of fun. Skip was really good to me, and I'd say he was one of the people that really helped me get moving into road course racing with that opportunity. So from there, just kept trying to get rides, and you know, my life, it was all about getting sponsors. Now, you got to understand, in my family, there's a whole long line at the sponsor door.
Right.
I got my dad, I got Uncle Al, I got Little Al and Bobby Jr. all in front of me. So that, I think, was the most frustrating and difficult thing I had in my career. Made it very difficult to for me to go the angle that, or the direction Al Jr. went, right?
Yeah.
Because the money just wasn't there for me. So I ended up doing things like Pikes Peak a little more. I really enjoyed Pikes Peak. Al Jr. didn't enjoy Pikes Peak so much. So I go when I'm, let's see, I'm just turned 18. And my dad and I hadn't spoken for a while during my sprint car days. We kind of get back to talking. I'm at Indianapolis. The year Uncle Al last wins Indy, it's at 87, I think. And I'm running a Champ Dirt car at the mile at the fairgrounds and get into a, connected with a guy into turn three. My radius rod broke, didn't really crash the car, but the radius rod broke out of the frame and stabbed my right leg between the torsion tube and that radius rod. So I had a double compound fracture. That was really bad. Had I not been in Indy with Trammell being there, probably would have lost my leg.
Yeah.
So they sewed it on, said, we'll see if it heals. We can always cut it off tomorrow. I heard that for 2 weeks. It healed, thank God. I raced Pikes Peak the first time. So this is May, the end of May. I raced Pikes Peak the first time in July 4th.
Oh, so, wow.
I can't even, I'm crutching. I've got a cast on my leg. I can't even push the brakes hard enough with the clutch in to lock up the tires on a dirt road. But we go up there in a Group A car, and I ended up winning the race. That got me an opportunity to go over to Europe a few months later, and I drove an Audi 200 in a Group A race, hill climb, won it in Germany, and ended up getting a World Hill Climb Championship. So that was pretty neat. I'm the only one in my family to actually have an FIA championship.
And, oh, really?
Yep. So I got that. The next year, I decided I wanted to run Pikes Peak again with an open wheeler. My dad and I went up there, picked out an old car. On the way home, I decided I wanted to be the car owner as well as a driver. So I called my brother. We started Unser Brothers Racing. So my first year up in an open wheeler was actually as, you know, driver owner, you know, move forward from that. And during this time, so back up into Speedway. So that's my Pikes Peak deal. Now, while I'm building my open wheeler, okay, so that's the year before. This is, I believe, this is going to be 87, I think.
Okay.
We find out about this AIS series. So there's a new IndyCar series that has been formed by Bill Tempero out in Fort Collins, Colorado.
Right.
This is going to be a stock block IndyCar with cars that are a couple years older. You know, right. Now, mind you, IndyCars, pretty much, you know, what do you do with an IndyCar after you've used it and you get a new IndyCar? Right. They kind of sit there, right? So a lot of depreciation. So it was an attempt to try to use some of the equipment that was out there and, you know, try to have a series that would bring up some up-and-coming drivers. So out of that, you know, Buddy Lazier was running it. So my dad talks to one of his old buddies, a guy by the name of Bill Smith, and I find myself flying in his airplane up to Lincoln, Nebraska to meet, you know, his kids.
Right.
So there we go. Dad and I fly up to Lincoln, Nebraska. I meet Carson. I meet Jason. We meet Bill. Of course, he already knew him. I hadn't. And Carson goes, yeah, we like him. We come up with, you know, a little Stroh's sponsorship and put the deal together. So I find myself out in Colorado to go to a test with Carson for the first time. And it's a little dinky track on the side of the road that's not even there anymore, north of Denver.
Mm-hmm.
So we go and we test. So now, mind you, at the same time, I'm actually building the same motors for Pikes Peak, right? Myself.
Right. And so we should point out, this is, you know, you think of an IndyCar, you think of some, you know, high winding European thing. This is small block Chevys that you're running in these IndyCar chassis. Yeah.
Basically a sprint car motor. So 360 injected, you know, full on sprint car motor, iron block, aluminum heads. So, which is actually the same thing I'm running all aluminum, but the same thing I'm running at Pikes Peak, right? My open wheel. Mm-hmm. So, we're in Colorado. We do that. We've got a Vertex mag on it. 5 and 6 were crossed. It was missing. Long and the short of it, through not only my driving, I think, but my ability to work on the car and sort things, Carson and I really got close quick. So I get with this Carson guy, and we start racing. And, you know, it's a, you know, quite a quick car. These cars were not very much slower than a regular Indy car. Not slower at all on a short track. The only place that that they would really got us is at, you know, like Indy, where they wound out. Their top speed was better, but in any road course or short track, the AIS cars were every bit as fast as a full-blown Indy car. So we start playing with stuff, and I realize that Carson's got a, I mean, he's just so brilliant. He, you know, we don't have AutoCAD in these days, right? We don't have any of this stuff. But anything I asked for, Carson just makes. So we ended up having a really interesting type of relationship where we just understood each other very well. I got to say, the whole team thought we were a little bit goofy, but we won a lot of races.
Yeah.
And, you know, for the most part, it's a weird language. I don't get it. I don't think Carson and I, either one of us, know, but when we get together and we want to do something, we really do it. And he never hiccuped. Now, you had Bill at the time, and I mean, we had to win everything, or Bill was just on you. It wasn't did you win?
Yeah.
Right. You know what I mean? You had a 3-hour lecture if you didn't win, and you better not do that again. So the competition was extremely strong. Again, we're running against Buddy Lazier. There's some really good drivers out there, Kevin Whitesides and Bill Tempero. There was some decent guys that came through there. So we just ran a lot. We get to the end of AIS. They finally call it. Now, so I'm driving the AIS car for Carson in Denver. The same weekend I'm driving for Peugeot at Pikes Peak. So mm-hmm. these are happening simultaneously.
And how old were you when all this was happening?
18.
Okay.
So I drove Peugeot with 18 and still have a broken leg, by the way, because they haven't finished fixing my leg yet. That was 13 surgeries in 2 years before I actually could walk again. So, you know, that's going on. So we go up, we win Erie, we're doing that. AIS quits. So we're sitting in the shop over on North 31st, me and Carson and the boys, and we're like, well, what the heck are we going to do now? And we came up with, all right, well, hell, let's try Pikes Peak. So we're looking at that Wells Coyote, right? I've brought it right up to Lincoln, and we're sitting there looking at it, and I'm like, man, there's just a whole lot of things I don't like about it. Now, mind you, a good friend of mine had just gotten killed in a Pikes Peak car literally the year before, Bobby Donner, at a not Pikes Peak race, but another hill climb where he hit a deer. Okay. And the deer came through the car and it ended up ending his life. So Carson and I are talking about that. And we're looking at this car, and I have to say, Carson's always really hardcore about safety. So he's like, you know, that thing doesn't look very good. And I'm like, yeah, I don't think I could hit a deer with that and make it. And so 20 minutes of talking, and it's like, well, let's just build a new car. And I'm like, well, how much does that cost? And Carson's like, yeah, you know, $1,500, $2,000. We'll be all right.
Build well, a new when car. You build it all from scratch, it's just cheaper than buying a chassis.
Yeah. And then we just, I mean, so, okay, we started thinking about a car, and literally I am staying in a little apartment that they own downtown, and I have this dream. I wake up at 1 o'clock in the morning, and bam, I have a picture in my head of the car. I run into the shop the next day, and I draw it on a piece of paper for Carson. I said, let's build the frame this way. And he says, all right. He takes me up, and that's the day he started teaching me AutoCAD. So he'd go to work. I'd sit at the shop all day in AutoCAD and freehand draw what I thought I'd see. He'd come home that night and help me put it into dimensions.
Right.
And then I slowly started learning how to actually, you know, put stuff in dimensions. So we drew out the basic, you know, side view of the car, right? Front view, just basic. Now, mind you, I don't have a sponsor. We don't know how we're going to pay for this. We realize we really need about $50,000 to run the whole year.
Yeah.
So I jump on a train. That's how broke I am. I jump on a train from Lincoln overnight, go to Denver to ask Jones Intercable, Glenn Jones, for a sponsorship. I need $5,000 to build the car. I need $50,000 to run the race. Okay. I walk into Glenn Jones's office. I have a plot, you know, a plotter thing of my car, you know, just the side view of the chassis that I want to build. It's not even complete. It's just the frame and basic deal.
Right.
I have my article from USA Today that I was in the year before because I won. And typically when I'm on Pikes Peak, I got a USA Today article, which is really cool. Mm-hmm. It's very nice to me. So I walk in with those two pieces of paper, and Glenn says, all right, here's $5,000. I can't give you the 50. Here's the $5,000 for the race, or for build the car, and I'm going to send you over to some friends I know. So give me a minute. And he calls over to TCI Cablevision, literally a half a mile down the road across the highway and just down a bit. And he says, go talk to these guys. So I go over there and I walk in, and lo and behold, they're having one of their, you know, meetings where all the people are in there.
Right.
So, all right, Robbie, come in. And dude, I walk into a board meeting. I was not prepared for that. You know, I think I'm going to go ask one guy for something. I walk in and I said, I'm, you know, wow. Okay. I'm asking for $50,000. I want to raise Pikes Peak.
Yeah.
Here's what I got last year. Here's what I want to build. And they said, so you're saying if you win this race, you're going to get a USA Today thing, you know, thing in USA Today.
Right.
And I said, yes. I get it every year. And he goes, all right, that's worth $50,000. We'll give you a check. Boom. And I walked out and I got on a train. I wasn't there 10 hours. I got on a train and went back to Lincoln and said, let's get the building. And there we were off. And that's the birth of the, you know, the big wing open wheeler. That was it. We went the first time we put the wings that I had had on the old Wells car.
Oh, okay.
That wasn't enough. We went out and tested. Yeah. So Carson and I were out in the middle of the boonies in Colorado testing. And we stop at a little gas station in Woodland Park, call Howard Milliken up. And I said, all right, Howard, these wings work great. I just need something that has like four times that amount of downforce at 80 miles an hour. And he thinks a little bit and he says, well, we got these modified wings. They're really heavy. But if we made one of those out of carbon fiber, maybe that would work. Mm-hmm. And so he knew a couple, dude, hippie man and wife up in the Sandias. Like, these people didn't even have, like, electricity. But they did carbon fiber, and they were great at it. Like, they made my carbon fiber leg cast for me that I drove with.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I had a separate cast I put on, and they made a bunch of the wing stuff for Gallus and all this stuff. So it was a pretty big expense. I mean, we paid like $6,000 for those things. And but we got these carbon fiber big wings. You've seen them. They're you know, 48 inches wide, 36 inches front to back, and two and three elements. We put one on the front, one on the back. And holy mackerel, I mean, we didn't even know what we had. That car all of a sudden starts doing wheelies on the dirt.
Oh, man.
And it can go through the neighborhood wide open and make 90-degree turns at 90 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like crazy. So much so that we started breaking input shafts, bottoming-out suspension.
Oh, yeah.
So we are literally racing it for the first time in 92, and we're already designing the second generation. Because,
right.
I mean, Carson had to change two input shafts while we were up there. We missed a day of practice because we just couldn't risk breaking the car.
Yeah.
Literally. It was, you know, it was that delicate. We had no idea we were going to get that much grip and traction.
So, and these are Hewlin transmissions, right?
Hewlin, not like you IndyCar can just go to the... transmissions, absolutely, yeah. Yep. IndyCar transmissions, but we have shorter input shafts. So an IndyCar has their oil tank between the transmission and the engine.
Oh, okay.
So it has about an 8 to 10 inch longer input shaft than we have.
Oh, okay.
Which gives it more wind up. Okay. Indy cars are turbocharged engines that don't have the torque. Fair enough. So we didn't realize it. We learned as we went, but we ran into a deal where that thing's starting to do wheelies and the torque and a shorter, you know, ride.
Yeah.
And it snapped. So,
and you're still on this thing. You're running an injected small block Chevy. It's basically still a big, gnarly sprint car motor.
Yeah. So it's a 4 pound per cubic inch weight. The car weighs 1,850 pounds. So we had a 420 or something inch engine. Okay. Basically, our, you know, sprint car engine hybrid thing that Carson did.
Right. Right.
So the first year we go up there, obviously win the race. What was cool about it, we're in the shop. I used to sit in this car and just sit in it, pretend I was driving it. And every now and then I'd say, hey, Carson. And he'd go, oh, my God, what? I think we need to rebuild the front suspension. I am not kidding. And you can ask him, we built the suspension three times before we ever put it on the first, even drove it.
Yeah, I believe that.
Ironically, we're sitting one night. It's 1 a.m. We're all leaving the shop. Carson goes, Robbie. He says, man, you know, is this thing going to work? And I looked at him. I said, it's going to run a 1052, Carson. And we ran a 1052 race day. It was really cool. Like, that's what it's going to do. And it did it. Absolutely did it. So we came back. We built another car. We went up the next year in 93. Now, mind you, by this time, we get a little attention. So Chevy's giving us some engine parts. We've hooked up with Motec. We are now working with Motec, and we put the first ever electronic injected deal up Pikes Peak with Motec. First time Motec was over here.
Well, and so this is because obviously from the bottom of the hill to the top, the air density is so dramatically different.
9,000 to 14,110 feet. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so that mechanical, you know, fuel injection, you've got some problems.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, it goes until it blubbers and then it goes out. So we wanted a fuel mapping. We didn't care about timing. Timing was fine. You know what I'm saying? We just needed something to adjust the fuel. So that was our first deal. We ended up putting on these other coils. Now, at Pikes Peak, you practice a third of the mountain each day. You qualify half of the mountain. And then race day, you run the whole mountain.
Okay.
Okay, so you never see the whole race, right? Your car never goes past halfway in one shot.
Right.
Fair enough. So heat, all these kind of things, you don't know until race day.
Yeah.
So race day, we're on pace to have run a 940 something track.
Which is hauling the mail. I mean, if you think about how long that track is, how long it is from the bottom of the mountain to the top, nine minutes is moving.
Oh, well, in 93, it had rained the night before. We got up and it was like a dream. It was the tackiest. I mean, I used to get to pick if you're a fast qualifier, do you want to run last or first? Okay. So last is typically what you run because they blow off all the dirt.
Right.
Fair enough. You get a good groove. You know, the more cars that can go up, the better the road's going to be. This morning, it was so good. We changed and went first. Blew everybody's mind. But it was just like the sweetest meat. I was just drooling. It was like, oh my God, I can't believe this thing is going to be this good. We were a half a minute faster to halfway than we were in qualifying. Geez. It was crazy. So I'm going up the W's and bah, boom. I knock the bottom of this engine, just goes out.
Oh, geez.
Don't know why. We're done. I mean, blew a motor. One of the only DNFs I've ever had at Pikes Peak.
Yeah.
So we didn't know why. We go back. I mean, we were just heartbroken. We're sitting at the bottom. It is actually, though, we did so good, it's what got us the Chevy factory deal. So we're sitting down there with our official and everybody, and they're like, well, you know what? We're going to go with you on the truck. So the next year, we actually built the truck and ran an open wheeler. So we go on forward with the Chevy factory deal. We build the truck. That was amazing. We had tunnels on it. We knocked out the front and back window. We let the air come through the cockpit. We had a big spoiler in the back. That thing had downforce. So we get to go to GM's wind tunnel. The open wheeler goes through at, I want to say, 4,400 pounds true weight. Remember, it weighs 1,850 sitting there. At 90 miles an hour true speed, the car weighed 4,500 pounds. 4,400 pounds. That's the downforce we were creating.
And those are still the carbon fiber wings that
carbon fiber
the
wings
hippies
are
made.
Set up.
Okay.
The interesting thing about the car that we didn't know that we found in the wind tunnel was as it yawed, as it got sideways, the car increased downforce and increased it proportionally to the rear.
Just exactly what you want.
I mean, how can you ask for anything better? So it actually had something where, you could lean on it, and the more you leaned on it, the more you got. The more you leaned on it, the more you got. The more you leaned, you know what I mean? And it really is still my favorite car I've ever driven. So we found that out. That was due just to the wickers and stuff we had. Our truck was the highest downforce coefficient car that had ever been in the wind tunnel without a wing on it.
Oh, wow.
It was a really cool time we had in the wind tunnel. And it turns out we really made some good downforce.
Yeah.
So we go up there. We're Chevy factory. We show up at Pikes Peak for the first week. They look at the car and say, you can't run that. And I'm like, absolutely, we can run that. You don't have a single thing in the rules. So imagine Chevy sponsors a race.
Right.
Chevy's our main sponsor of our team. They're telling us we can't run. So now there's six lawyers involved.
Oh,
geez. We had a court case before we even went to practice the first day. So we ended up, we made some concessions. They let us run. We pulled our, spoiler back on the front, and we took down our wicker in the back, and we did a couple things, and we ended up not suing them, and everybody ended up okay. We ran. So we went up and we did it. Of course, the rule book changed drastically by the end of that race. And
that's one of the best compliments you can get when you have to. They have to rewrite the rule book for you.
Our Carson and I are responsible for at least half of that rule book, I guarantee. So about this time, I end up going into Indy Lights and kind of finally getting the opportunity to go to Indy. So that happens. And kind of Pikes Peak dies from us, and, you know, that kind of goes away. So then I go on and I run Indy, and, you know, a couple years of that, get hurt really bad and kind of have to go back and heal a little bit. And then, you know, just kept getting older and keep doing things.
You know, it's not every day that you get a chance to talk to somebody who's run Indy. And here we are. What is it like? You know, that's a pretty big deal. That's a Super Bowl of auto racing. What's it like
Very
to sit
intense.
There on the grid at Indy?
Yeah. So Indy is one of those places, well, and Pikes Peak too. So when you walk, well, okay, I say this. Now consider that I come from a point of view where it was a pretty big deal in my life, my family, and everything else. Right.
Right.
So I may have a reverence for these places other people don't. Fair enough. But
right, sure.
With that said, I feel like when you go into Indy, it's like church is the
right.
best way. You don't spit on the ground. You don't throw any trash on the ground. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You see a piece of trash, pick it up and throw it in the trash can. You're so thankful to be there. And this is Indy. So I ran really good there. Now, mind you, I'm older. I was like 32 by the time I got there. Okay, so, you know, I wasn't the 20-year-old going to Indy. Now I'm a 30-year-old going to Indy.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
I think it helped. I had more maturity about me. My racecraft was, I think, quite good. You know, I ran fifth my first year. I ran eighth my second year. In 2 years, I really did. If you just go for 2 years of racing, my stats were as good as anyone in the family, if not better.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that's where it ended. So my stats stopped. But I had a great time at Indy. It is, you know, you're going, the first gear is 90 miles an hour.
Oh, geez.
Okay. So we'll start there. So getting onto the racetrack is the hardest thing you do at Indy. The cars at 150 are scary. Just bloody scary.
I believe that.
Like riding a buckboard.
Yeah.
Okay. Especially in those days. They're a little more docile now, but they were very scary. You had to get up to about 200 before anything just started working.
Sure.
So you're just at speed and you have to be patient. You have to look way down the road. You have to be very calm. You know, you have to really think ahead of what's happening.
Yeah.
'Cause it's happening fast. And you don't realize everyone's doing it. So it's really kind of like you're going down the freeway.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's that aspect, but until something goes wrong and then you realize, holy mackerel, this is really bad, you know.
You're covering a lot of ground mm-hmm. in a short amount of time.
A football field, a second. But it was fun. The fans, I can't tell you how the experience of Indy driving is one thing, but the race, the reverence of the fans, the people that know everything, the knowledge of the fans, you know, the museum,
right.
The Holman family, Tony George, everything that's gone on. I mean, you just, to take it in, it really is a magical experience. You know, driving is cool, but there's a lot of places you kind of drive like that. Indy's special, you know, but you go fast, but the town, the months, you know, and I was lucky enough we still had a month, right? You know, now it's a shortened up 2-week deal. So, you know, I had 2 weekends of qualifying and, you know, so I'm really happy I had a chance to run in the old way.
Right.
You know, they've shortened that up quite a lot. I didn't have 3 opportunities to go out and qualify. You had one.
Yeah.
You better get her done. You know, hope. If you had to do 2 or 3, you were in trouble. Now you were trying to get back into the show, you know?
Yeah.
So it was neat. AJ was still there. You know, Rutherford was still around. So I really feel like I was lucky. I made it there.
Yeah.
Thank God, you know, and I did well. Didn't continue, but that's okay. You know, that's That's fine. God had other things in mind for my life on that aspect, but it was an amazing experience. You know, it's something that I'll never forget for sure.
Here's where we're going to fast forward a bit to 2015. Carson Smith calls Robbie out of retirement to once again drive a car for Speedway Motors. This time, they're modified muscle cars competing in autocross competitions. Bill Schneider is one of our engineers and the head of Team Speedway. He's going to join in a little later on to discuss how he's harnessed all the mechanical mayhem into a valuable engineering tool. The first time I met you, I was working in the shop building what was just meant to be a Nova to sort of show off this G-Comp suspension that we'd come up with that was meant to make a grocery getter Nova go around corners. And we had blown the engine up on the road course. And by the time the car made it back to the shop with a blown engine, with rods sticking out of the oil pan, we were told that we had something like 3 days to turn it around because this Robbie Unser character was coming in to drive the car at an SCCA event. And so we had changed the engine. We added an AccuSump and some changes to the oiling system, completely rebuilt the fuel system because it was pulling so many G's, it was pushing fuel out the filler. And we had all, you know, basically sweat blood for 3 days to get this thing ready to go. And in walks Robbie Unser, and he shakes our hands and, you know, hi, nice to meet you. And we start the car and back it out the door. And you were going to go test it in the parking lot. And we hadn't even had a chance to take the grease rags out of our pockets and walk around the corner. And we hear this thing just wide open, 7,000 RPM drifting between the semi-trailers in the parking lot. I'm like, well, I guess this is how this is going to go. And this is how this Unser character is going to handle this. And it's kind of been like that ever since.
Well, yeah, that's what I do, you know, that's just the way it is. So from my perspective, I get a call. Of course, I'd been up, I think about a year before and put together that first open wheeler that went to a museum. Okay. So yeah. I had to come up to Lincoln with my nephew, Jason. We put that car together. I took it to the museum at the Broadmoor. For Pikes Peak. So then after that, Bill had passed. I was really lucky to have a chance to spend quite a lot of time with Bill that trip when I was up here, which was just a few months before he passed away. He passes away, come up for, you know, obviously the funeral and stuff. And then I want to say it wasn't 3 or 4 months after that that this deal happened.
Yeah, that sounds
right.
And so
Carson calls me up one day and he says, you know, they were trying to find drivers. I think they were talking to Mike Mayer, a bunch of good, you know, SCCA guys.
Right.
All great drivers. But Carson and Jason go, well, whoa. Let's make a call first and see if Robbie will do this. Obviously, we have a big history. And, I mean, Carson knows if you're trying to figure out a car, I'm a very good choice. I mean, I'm going to put it through its paces. And I think I've got a fairly decent knack at not just breaking it, but knowing it's going to break and how to fix it.
Right.
You know, so he says, you want to come up and drive this thing? So I fly up to Lincoln. Now, mind you, I haven't really driven a car in a few years. So what's even funnier is that thing you did, that's the first time I had been really in something in probably 3 or 4 years.
Oh, wow.
So that still feels like a car. So things came back pretty quick.
It all came back pretty fast.
You know, and if you remember, the car would get on two wheels in the corners. It would bicycle.
And you never knew which two it was going to be.
Never knew which ones, exactly. But we have pictures of it carrying the inside tires at that SCCA event that we had first. And so we got through that week. I was up here, a week, I think?
Something like
I got
that,
here like on a Monday or Tuesday. You guys had just fixed the deal. And then we ended up running the SCCA thing, which I had never done before either.
Right.
You know, cone racing.
Cone racing is a totally different deal.
Sure. Very different. And I used to just give Randy Popes all kind of trouble for it. And looks like I got to take that back if I ever see him again. So, you know, turns out it's pretty tough. But it was tough. But it was fun. You guys worked really hard. Anything I asked for, you guys really worked hard to give me. We started rebuilding a lot of things. If you remember, I needed brake bias. We needed pedal. I mean, I just started with a whole list of stuff that, you know, let's make it happen. quicken the steering. So, you know, Dave over at the machine shop started making pieces. You were working late at night, you know, and we just started developing the car. I got to say, one of my proudest things is that Nova. I love that car. And it took the year, you know, as you know, we developed it for a year. We went through various models of the G-Comp suspension. We went through various changes on spindles and rear ends and all kinds of stuff, right? We towed the rear ends in. We started doing a lot of stuff. And ironically, the next year decided to keep going with it. And we won the championship with Good Guys against a bunch of vets. So the car, I think, is an iconic Nova. Anyone that's seen it run knows it. If we just say we're giving rides, the line to that car is the longest. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's not the fastest thing in the world because of the size of tires, but I promise you it's the most fun thing you'll ever drive.
Yeah.
You know, so still my favorite car to drive.
That's funny to hear you say that because, you know, we evolved then forward and built that 67 Camaro, which was just a full-on all-out, you know, let's get
and
the biggest tire.
I like him, too.
And
I like her, too. She's my little lady.
but that Nova, you know, I'm not upset to hear you say that because that Nova is a great car.
If you said you can take one car, I'd pick the Nova.
Really?
Yeah. And the 67 is just incredible. Okay, it is a bad beast. Well, look, we built it, you know, understand, Corvettes are winning everything. Right. We want to beat the Corvettes, but, you know, we don't want to do it in a vet. So we decided we wanted to do it in a Camaro. We found these tires, you know, Bill, and we're all sitting down there in Phoenix going, well, if we run those, maybe we can do it. We built that car. You guys worked really hard over the winter. We got thing out. We tested it. I mean, it had some issues early on, but we sorted them out, right? And ended up winning Columbus and Scottsdale in it.
And that win at Scottsdale was Autocrosser of the Year, which is kind of as far as the Good Guys Autocross goes.
That's the biggest one you get.
Kind of the biggest one you get.
Yep. Danny Pop, I think, had 11 years of winning those in a row.
Uh-huh. It was something. He'd won for quite a while in a Corvette.
Yeah.
I am personally, you know, I'm basically just a hot rod fabricator. That's racing is something that I didn't grow up that way. You know, it was sort of all new to me, and that's how we all sort of learned together when you came on board. But that win at Scottsdale, watching you know, it's a shootout. You go against another car and you get you know, one guy gets eliminated, one guy moves on to the next round.
Yep.
And we knew what you had qualified at. We knew what you'd been running all weekend. And then to watch you as the heat was on and as more and more rounds went by, to watch you go faster by like a lot, you know, not like just a hundredth of a second, but like a half a second, and then to go on to win, that will always be personally one of the moments that I will never forget. And I don't think I'll ever see anything like it again.
It was cool. I mean, we knew. We brought a knife to a gunfight, but we knew if we could get close enough, we could stab him.
Yeah.
So we just had to, you know, think very hard. We knew that in one or two runs, they were going to get us. But if they gave us three or four in a row, our tires get warm.
Yeah.
Now things are a little different.
Right.
And it was a hard fought race. I mean, you know, ended up going head to head against a Cobra. And that ain't an easy deal in a big old Camaro. So for me, it was a very honorable win as well. I think it was straight up. It was honest. We would have won the next year. You know, it's not that the car just wins easily. We have to think. We have to work.
Yeah.
I mean, our team has to get it right. We're constantly tuning it. The Corvettes seem to be, you know, faster, more generally easy, I would say, right? They kind of just generally run quicker with less effort. But on a given day, on any given Sunday, we'll pull one out.
And, you know, we talk about this being cone racing. And, you know, it's not Indy where you're going 220 miles an hour down the straights. It's tends to be a lower speed. Mm-hmm. But it is brutal.
Brutal.
And, you know, I've been in the car with you enough times to see, you talk about your dad hitting you with the stick when you lifted too soon. And I can see that you know, going down a straightaway, and I would have been hard on the brakes 30 feet before you even think about lifting, and you just got to wonder if you're going through that Jersey barrier. But but it's as a way to test a suspension system and as a way to test a car, I can't think of anything better, because all really the force, it's on 100% the throttle, 100% on the brakes, 100% to the right, 100% to the left, over and over and over and over. And it's just like a built-in real-world cycle test.
Right. And so what we found early on, the weird luck, kind of the hidden little angel in the clouds that we found, was that, what you just said. You know, we didn't know we were getting into that, fair enough. But as we started seeing, this really beats the cars up bad.
Oh, yeah.
Hence, Team Speedway grew. And then, you know, Bill, now I'm more of a driver that just Bill says, okay, go do this, go do that. And, you know, it's accepted. I'm going to drive that way. And they're using it and getting all the engineering out of it. And I mean, Bill, how many things have we changed over that? I mean, our spindles are...
I would imagine 80% of the 80% of the structural components on any one of these suspension systems is probably been tweaked because of it. In general, a cycle test needs a full reversal. So if you're going left for a while and then you're going right for a while, I would consider that a full reversal. If you're just going to sit there and spin around in a circle, you don't get near the force on any of the structure. So anywhere from spindles to shocks to shock mounts to any structural thing that has to resist the car momentum has been changed, tweaked, and improved. And that's what this whole system that we have in place is for. We know that Robbie will absolutely wring the most out of the car he can possibly get, and that will break something. Well, yeah. We want to find the weak link, and what we're trying to do here ultimately is sell suspension components for Speedway. So we also have to do due diligence at that point in time so they don't break and they're going to be on people's cars, and they have to be safe, and they have to conform to what is considered an acceptable range of reliability.
And Bill, your background is in engineering, but you were engineering cranes where the ramifications of something breaking or coming apart could be pretty huge. And so how do you kind of apply that to what we're doing with these cars?
The similarities are numerous, especially when it comes to the cycle test part. I would say that without question, what I just had said, we used to cycle test construction equipment. And you could set it up and you could lift 100,000 pounds 10 feet away from a test stand and sit there and turn circles all day with it. Mm-hmm. What would break it would be to lift up that 100,000 pounds, turn it, and then try to stop it and try to go the other way.
Oh, right.
Immediately, that would break something. So the key is people do that. So they can't break. So that's how that design would get developed and be reliable. Same thing as this. There's so much similarity in the cycle test of these vehicles comparatively to construction equipment. It's surprising.
This just happens to be a little more fun.
Right. This is a lot more fun. Yeah. Depending on where you're at, it's a life-changing event. So if you're in the passenger seat and hanging on for dear life at 140 miles an hour, you kind of get it.
And obviously the trickle down of all of this is as we under these outrageous forces and craziness that we're subjecting these components to, as we see something that fails or might fail, that trickles down to the products we sell, where we make sure that sort of safety margin is built into all of those suspension components so that even if somebody is going to subject a car to a racing application, we know that it's going to hold up and keep them safe.
Right.
Yeah. I think the safety aspect is one of it, but you also have to go with the performance aspect. You know, you have, not only does it have to hang together, it's got to do what it's supposed to do. Everybody likes to win, right? So it's got to be fast, but for the people that are buying these suspensions, the safety is obviously important, but they also expect it to work right. So that's where it comes from. You know, I started on the whole Team Speedway thing on the engines. I was doing the electronic engine management and, right. and building tunes and whatever. And then it just, I could just see, it was kind of, in my opinion, it wasn't going exactly the direction you need to sell components. And we've got the direction now. So it's, you know, we're selling systems and there's a lot of people calling in and getting advice. And, you know, I think we're having some success with the whole Team Speedway approach, how we're doing it. And people go for rides with Robbie, and the next thing you know, they're talking to me and buying a suspension kit.
So, right. Yeah. And, you know, I think there's something to be said about sort of the tribal knowledge of running these cars out of our own house. You now, Bill, know exponentially more about electronic engine management than you did 4 years ago. I know more about how to build a race car than I did 4 years. You know, we're all sort of learning and sort of pulling everybody forward as we acquire more and more knowledge about, you know, how to build a car and how to build the right components to sell.
Yeah, I think for example, to that point, yes, a couple of days ago, we just took a couple of cars out to the Hastings MPH road course.
Yeah.
And one day before we went, I knew that 67 wasn't running right, and one look at the computer and you could see we had a reverse polarity on a throttle position sensor.
Oh, okay.
Now, if I would have tried that 3 years ago, it'd take me half a day to figure it out.
Yeah.
So I kind of got that part handled.
And that's, speaking of that very specifically, one of my favorite things about that 67 Camaro is we pulled pieces from Carson's sort of personal stash to build that car. And I didn't quite realize, as he would show up to the shop with a component, I didn't necessarily always realize what it was. But then, you know, come to find out, that stack fuel injector that's on that Camaro also happens to have been a Pikes Peak fuel injector, which also happens to be the one that you guys ran the Motec electronic injection on.
Yeah.
So that thing has been up the hill, and I, you know, I get kind of emotional about things like that. You know, you watch that video of you going up in the open wheeler, you can see there's those cast aluminum Chevrolet valve covers. Well, those happen to be the same valve covers that are on that 67. I think that's really cool. I think that sort of the spirit and the soul in those parts that gets, yep, to live on now in another race car, that just makes me happy.
And that's what I want. I mean, that's why I told Carson when we started doing the 67, Carson and I got together and I asked for a couple things. Obviously, we all decided the tires, fair enough. I wanted it to look like a Hot Wheels car, right? I wanted it to,
yeah,
be colorful. Remember, we had all those meetings and I wanted suspensions to be a color and frame to be, you know, so when a kid, mm-hmm, walked up, they thought it was a Hot Wheel car. And you guys did great. Every kid that's ever seen that, including yesterday, a 5-year-old walked up and said, "That's a Hot Wheel car." Right on. I mean, we've got that down. So
yeah,
that was an aspect. And then I wanted the old school. Remember, we had the big, do we do LS or do we do an old school engine?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was real important to do that old Pikes Peak engine. What you don't know about that Pikes Peak engine is that block was special. Okay. They didn't make a lot of those blocks.
Yeah.
They made a few of those blocks for us. Right.
And this was GM when you were sponsored by GM.
Yeah. So those were to fit the cubic inches for the open wheeler. Think about it, as a 420 small block. In those days, that's not easy to get.
Yeah.
So that deck had to be a different height. Follow what I mean? That injector had to be a different type of injector to fit on,
right,
that valley. All of that stuff was kind of one off. And so we had to go in our old stash of stuff in Carson's little engine room. Carson and I spent digging out. Remember, we had those couple sets of heads that weren't machined,
yeah,
yet,
yeah,
for it and all that kind of stuff. So it was cool for us to bring that stuff back. Now, it doesn't have the power that an LS does. And I think the future of the 67 is going to needs to see an LS, right? You know, but we did what we did with it. And I say that engine needs to come out, go in the museum, and we'll put, you know, for the car to,
yeah,
continue to grow. The power that's in the Nova and the 70 is freaking unbelievable, right?
And both of those cars are LS engines.
They're both big cubes. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think they're the same engine, aren't they? Pretty much, one's carbureted, one's electronic, is only.
Right, but yeah, they're, you know, that's a fairly high-end LS configuration.
Yeah.
One of the Nova's running 800-plus horsepower, and of course, Robbie likes that one. And I don't know if it's just going to fit in there exactly, but going forward, we might.
Thanks to Robbie Unser for being our guest today, and thanks to all of you for listening to What Moves You, a Speedway Motors podcast. Visit the toolbox at speedwaymotors.com for the photos we referenced in today's episode. Email the podcast at podcast@speedwaymotors.com. If you like what you heard, tell a friend where to find us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.